thank you for downloading the Science Hour from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. And in 30 minutes, if you can count them all, you can hear why other animals need to keep track of number.
It's important in defence of your territory. It's also avoidance of death. It's about finding food. It's important for sex. There are lots of reasons why being able to assess the number of things in your environment is going to be important for animals.
I'm counting on Marnie Chesterton to explain animal numeracy on Crowd Science later in the podcast. Before that, on Science in Action, it's the human mind we're interested in and what boiled crab shells could offer the future of renewable green electricity.
And we are hungry for food, we're also hungry for energy. Given the demand of battery technologies and the demand of materials associated with those technologies, there's going to be a very interesting future for this kind of materials used in batteries.
Intriguing. Before that, let's dive into the profound question of what makes us human. Intelligence, for one thing, surely, but also caring for one another, which we do unconsciously every day, but I'd argue is key. Let's deal with that in a moment and start with thinking power. Something happened over the past 6 million years as our ancestral species diverged from our primate cousins to give us the intellectual edge. And a key step has just been identified that made us different, smarter than our Neanderthal cousins. A tiny mutation that changed one small part of one large protein called TKTL1, but I don't expect you to remember that, which affects not the adult brain, but its growth in the fetus, accelerating it. More neurons in the right place, more brain power. The hard work was done by Annelien Pinson, but it fulfills a dream her colleague Wieland Huttner has long nurtured at the Max Planck Institute of Molecular Cell Biology and Genetics.
We have been interested, our lab, since 25 years, in genes that make the human brain big in evolution. And we found one called RGAP11B that, when we put it in a monkey, makes the primate brain bigger. Interestingly, this gene is equally present in the genome of Neanderthals, being consistent with the fact that Neanderthal brains and modern human brains were roughly equal in size. Knowing this, we became interested in exploring whether perhaps there are differences in brain development, neocortex development to be precise, between modern humans and Neanderthals. And this led then to the project that Annelien started.
Because it's possible to get DNA, you can actually start to examine subtle differences between the Neanderthals and us.
Absolutely right. And the organoid technology, in the end, would allow to make a Neanderthalized organoid not just for one gene, but for many genes, and then ask the question, what happens in these organoids?
And Adeline, when Wieland talks about organoids, these are little cell cultures of, I presume in this case, these are of some kind of neural tissue that you're working with.
Well, they are embryonic stem cells that we derive to produce what we call mini brains, or yes, cerebral organoids. So at the end, they form like a small tissue, a small brain-like structure.
What caught my eye with your paper is that there is this particular gene, and there's one small difference in that gene that then you think is making the difference, or a difference between us and the Neanderthals. And this is a gene involved in the development of the brain.
The change in the gene was already published in terms of the sequence of the gene. And what I did is study the function of that gene in the developing brain. And so I used different models, mouse, ferret, and cerebral organoids model, to look if the one amino acid difference between modern human and Neanderthal TKTL1 sequence would have a function in the development of the brain. And what I saw is that the modern human TKTL1, but not the Neanderthal TKTL1, increases the abundance of one specific type of progenitor cells that we call the basal radial glia cells.
When you say there's one change in an amino acid, with all the COVID stories we've been talking about, I think our listeners are more familiar with this. This is one change in one chemical brick of a whole protein and that's all it took, was just this one switch that would have been representing a mutation in the genome.
Yes, correct. It's only a point mutation that leads to a change in one amino acid.
And when you're saying that this is a gene which is expressed, in other words, a protein which is present in stem cells, the point is this is about how the brain will be growing in a fetus. It's not about the functioning of the brain itself.
Well, the functioning of the brain, of course, depends on the number of neurons you have to start with. And so the role of the progenitors very directly has an impact on the later functioning of the brain, because if you don't make enough neurons, your brain will not function.
How do you then study the effect of this change in a particular gene on the way that that the brain cells develop?
Well, there are different ways. The first way is to introduce the expression in a model organism like the mouse, and to compare, to introduce either the modern human or the Neanderthal version, and to compare the effect on the number of progenitor cells and on the number of neurons by counting those cells.
And you also there are also some tissue experiments. You were talking about organoids, mini brains.
So yes, so we did two different type of tissue experiments. The first one was knockout using CRISPR-Cas9 in human fetal neocortical tissue.
This is a kind of gene editing that's quite new.
Yes, correct. And there we did the knockout, and we saw that by doing that, we reduced the number of the type of progenitor that is increased when we overexpress modern human TKTN1. So it shows the physiological importance.
And so in both the mouse experiments and these tissue culture experiments, you were able to show that introducing this small change changes the amount of material that's produced, the number of brain cells that are being produced in this system.
Correct.
And Wieland, was that what you're expecting?
No, I mean, we were totally stunned when Annelien showed me the first data in the mouse and said, look, only one type of basal progenitor is increased. Remember, the RGAP11B gene that we studied previously increases any type of basal progenitor. And here we have this other gene which increases only one type of basal progenitor. That was a big surprise.
Okay, so you're expecting a change. Why is it important that there's one type of cell that is affected?
Yes, so this type of cells is more efficient to produce neurons than the other type of basal progenitor.
You're talking about a relatively small mutation in this gene, but its effect would be, this would happen in the fetus while the embryo is developing as a baby. That one change would allow more and more and more neural cells to be developed. In other words, the brain to have more capacity, I guess.
Exactly correct. And in fact, what is interesting is that Annelien could show that it is the so-called upper layer neurons, which are the neurons that are born last and which are known to be particularly important for cognitive abilities, that are increased. And we think it is actually a critical component of our cognitive abilities compared to Neanderthals. And the reason why I say this is based on the results of the knockout in fetal human tissue. Had there been redundancy, if there were, say, 50 genes that do a similar thing, you would not see a decrease in the level of basal radial glia if you knock out just this one gene. But knocking out this one gene was enough to reduce the level of basal radial glia, which makes the point that TKTL1 is a major player to keep up the level of basal radial glia to the maximum level that modern humans have.
It strikes me, if one small change in this protein can have this effect, you know, maybe there's someone walking around with a second change that's amplified the effect even further. You know, it seems to me that there's a very delicate balance in this sort of stem cell chemistry there.
Absolutely possible. But the spread of such an quote-unquote improved TKTL1 across 8 billion human beings would take a while, because, as you know, smaller populations are better to introduce new traits by genetic change.
I was wondering if there are any therapeutic implications to this finding.
Of course, we all talk about cell replacement strategies in neurodegenerative diseases. And since this gene can make basal radial glial cells divide and grow in number, one could think of using it if one wanted to replace basal radial glial stem cells in those cases of neurodegenerative diseases where certain neurons are dying.
Wieland Huttner and Annalene Passon, their thorough and intricate experiments are detailed in the journal Science Today. So, what do you do with all that brain power? Care for one another, as I said. And evidence for this in an extreme form comes from a cave burial site tens of thousands of years old, discovered in Borneo. This predates the establishment of stable communities and agricultural life by millennia. Certainly, writing and what we think of knowledge. Yet, among the skeletal remains found by a team of Australian and Indonesian investigators are those of a child who'd been given severe surgery, amputation, and survived. Archaeologist and former nurse Charlotte Roberts has seen the evidence and told me what she made of it.
This skeleton's really fascinating. It's a fantastic find. This person died between the 19 and 20 years of age, was buried carefully in a cave in Borneo. And the key thing to see in the skeleton of this person was an amputation site. So amputation of the part of the lower left limb and foot. And remarkably, evidence of healing of the ends of the bones.
So this was an amputation long before the individual died?
Yes. Person lived probably between 6 and 9 years following the amputation. Very, very well healed.
And so that means also then that this was done to a child?
Yes. A child probably aged between 11 and 14 years.
What is different about an amputation from, let's say, an animal bite or some kind of, injury?
Well, the cut on the bones is very straight, and if you were injured, say, in your leg, it would be a much more ragged appearance. And the authors really studied in detail the evidence in the skeleton and came to that conclusion by talking to medics, people who actually do amputations today.
And the authors make a big deal of the sophistication to be able to do this.
Of course, today it's very safe. People are anaesthetised. There are sterile procedures. Blood loss is controlled and infection is controlled. And if infection ensues after the operation, it's treated with antibiotics. 31,000 years ago, it would have been a very different scene because we cannot be sure whether this person was given some sedation or anaesthesia, whether they actually deliberately tried to stem bleeding that would ensue, and whether, if they got an infection, they treated it with, again, plant resources from their environment.
Can you tell even from the nature of the repair that it was, how successfully the recovery was? I was just thinking how many things can go wrong, even today, as you say, after an amputation, the bleeding, the possibility of infection, all kinds of other complications that would mostly kill people off.
Well, the fact that this person survived makes me think, well, this society really cared. They cared about the person during their life and they cared when this person died, giving a careful burial to the individual. You know, that hunter-gatherers are usually on the move a lot of the time, and it would have been much easier to look after this person if they were living in a settled farming community where there were a lot more people around. People could stay at home and look after them while the others went out to work. So it's just a remarkable story this skeleton has told us.
You know, we sort of think of sophistication and knowledge coming thousands, tens of thousands of years later when the first sort of agricultural communities were formed or cities. So, you know, presumably the state of knowledge is very different. But the humanity of these people, let's say, with a child, with a maybe a terminally injured limb, and wanting to do something about it. That sort of human urge seems to be absolutely there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, caring is an inherent part of being human, I think. And it goes back thousands and thousands of years, and we see it again here with this burial.
The other aspect of this, which I think is quite interesting, is the archaeology, which is your business, and the idea that we can even tell anything about people's state of health, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 years ago seems to me remarkable.
Yeah, what we do when we're studying skeletons is you know, it's quite challenging because not all diseases affect the skeleton, you know, and this sort of evidence, an amputation treatment in a skeleton is rare, a rare find. But there is evidence for amputation in other periods of time. But, you know, if you're looking at bodies, preserved bodies with soft tissues like mummies, you're likely to find much more evidence for treatment because you've got those soft tissues available, you know, for treatment of skin lesions and that sort of thing. So it's quite a tricky business trying to work out what's going on in the skeleton, but you'll find a lot more evidence of things like osteoarthritis in skeletons than you will amputations.
And those are the kinds of conditions our ancestors had to live with all the time. I just, you know, it reminds me in a way of how brutal life must have been. And even to do an amputation like this, you know, Stone Age, presumably with some kind of stone tool, in one sense, I'm totally horrified by it. But I guess it does reflect that need to look after one another.
Yes, I think that carries right through to today and thinking about the last few years with COVID. We need to look after each other, and hopefully we will in the future. There's some amazing images in later periods of time of people being given amputations. Incredible. And, of course, there's lots of historical documents to go with the images. But with prehistory, you're just basically looking at the evidence in skeletons. And, you know, the only real evidence would be dentistry, trepanation, drilling holes in the head. We've got quite a bit of evidence for that, often very successfully, and then amputation. You also do see some evidence for splints around fractured limbs in Egypt. And, of course, the Egyptians talked a lot about treatment of fractures. But it's very limited evidence for prehistory, certainly.
I presume that we know incredibly little about what may have been possible 30,000 years ago in terms of other kinds of medicine, treatments with plants, whatever. I don't know, you know. This must be a pretty rare find in that sense.
I'm sure they would have been using what was in their environment. And you know, and again, more recent periods, people were using herbs for all sorts of things, for treatments. And I'm sure they wouldn't have ignored what was in their environment. In the sort of 16th, 17th century in Europe, there were bone setters that went round villages setting, you know, fractured bones. And they were, considered to be the experts for treating fractures. But whether there was anybody like that 31,000 years ago going around the different hunter-gatherer societies and doing the same thing, I don't know.
Do you have any sense of length of survival in pre-Common Era times, before the Common Era, survival times of someone with this degree of injury? Because clearly, you know, once you've had, in a hunter-gatherer society, once you've lost a major part of a limb, your chances are massively reduced in any case, and you may be more susceptible to infections and stuff as well, I imagine.
Yeah, because your mobility will be limited. Even if you can hobble around on a makeshift crutch, you're not going to be able to chase after wild animals, are you? And we don't know what killed this person in the end, but yeah. Yes.
Which is sad in a way.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I can't remember the question.
it was about survival.
Oh, survival.
You know,
whether
you find equivalent things, individuals from, let's say, the Egyptian times, and yeah, they had some kind of major surgery and they died 20 years or 10 years later. Oh, it's fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it.
That's all right. It's a pleasure.
Charlotte Roberts, Emeritus Professor of Archaeology at Durham University. Her commentary and the original work are available at Nature. Links on our bbcworldservice.com webpage. The other thing to do with all that brain power is to shape and improve, we hope anyway, the world around us. But as heat waves, floods, storms worldwide just this year have shown, though, our mastery of fossil fuels has brought its own problems. Renewables and electricity are seen as a key part of the solution. Yet, energy storage is needed to smooth out their intermittent character. Lithium-ion batteries have taken the world by storm, but they also have their downsides for people and the planet. So my eye was caught by a study making alternatives with the chemistry of zinc and boiled crab shells. Liangbing Hu, who led the research at the University of Maryland, assured me this makes sense.
Looking into the future, we're going to have a huge demand on energy storage. And it's hard to say lithium battery will meet all the necessary demand in the future. And the zinc battery comes with its unique advantages in terms of faster charge of the battery, in terms of potential low cost. And in the end, there is a new chemistry that can enable features like, for example, biodegradable batteries, flexible batteries, and so on. So I would say it's really add a new as a new family member to this entire energy storage in the technology portfolio.
That's interesting. I think of zinc as being a much more common or easily accessible metal than lithium. Maybe it's easier to process as well.
Yeah, that's another aspect, as well as how abundant zinc is compared to lithium.
So that's the zinc. Where do the crabs come into this?
So you have the positive electrode and you have the negative electrode. And the voltage difference between the positive and the negative is the voltage of your battery. And sitting between the positive and the negative is the electrolyte and the separator. So this is actually where the crab-based material fall.
It's an interesting thing. A battery basically always has sort of two reactive components and then this bit in between that has to, I guess, control the reactivity and generate that electrical current that we take advantage of, and that's the electrolyte. So that's the role of the electrolyte. But I mean, this idea of using crab shells, I mean, it's to me it sounds pretty bizarre.
Yeah. So if you look into crab shell, like a similar to shrimp, lobster shell. And those materials basically has its essential component. It's called chitin. And chitin is the second most abundant biomaterial. The first one is cellulose from trees, from biomaterials. That's the first, the most abundant one. My group work a lot on that material as well.
What's it like? Is it some kind of fibrous material or is it more like a shell, you know, like a sort of shiny shell?
Basically a polymer, so it's like a fibrous structures.
And so a bit like the cellulose in wood.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. They're not identical, the same, but they basically is a biopolymer with a lot of very useful functional groups.
So what do you do in the lab then? You're taking crab shells or lobster shells, is it? You're dissolving them, you're crushing them, or what? How do you process them into the material that you need?
Yeah, so we actually, in this particular work, we purchase the processed crab shell material and we process it into chitin. We can also start from the beginning of the crab shell itself. So this is actually a very common practice. What's our innovation in this particular work is that we find a way to basically get all this chitin, all these building blocks together using the zinc ion. So the basically zinc ion, you know, basically grab all these fibers together through this coordination structure. We dissolve them into this boiling sodium hydroxide solution at 100 degrees C overnight. And you have this so-called chitin. and you take this chitosan, and you know, we continue the process to make this zinc iron coordinate structure.
So you load it up, you load the paste with zinc ions, and then that becomes part of this chemical circuitry you're talking about.
Exactly, yeah, you're right. And one of the crucial steps, as you see in the first figure of the paper, is actually we densify it. We squeeze out all the free water. So we have this very dense membrane that actually can confine the zinc ion to go through the membrane in a very controllable way.
And then what, you put your zinc electrodes either side of that and then attach the electricity?
Exactly. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, I have to say, I don't think of crab shells and think of electricity in the same, you know, in the same thought. It just seems like a very bizarre thing, but I guess you know more about crab shell chemistry than I do.
Actually, there are a lot of people working on this kind of biopolymers. It's actually become very, you know, popular topics, and there are many different ways of using these kind of materials in drug delivery, packaging and so on, yeah.
And now in batteries. I mean, when you go and package them all up like this in your prototype battery, the key question is, does it work? How good is a zinc chitosan battery compared to what else is on offer?
We're reporting this work. We can charge the battery at very high current density, up to 40 milliampere per centimeter square. So this current density is very high. And usually a typical lithium-ion battery, it's about like a 2 to 3.
So 10 times as fast?
In that particular parameter, yeah.
Yeah.
And I would like to point out that this kind of battery has this unique advantage compared with lithium-ion battery, such as the biodegradability of this battery chemistry and the potential low cost because of the use of zinc and this biomaterial. So.
And I've talked to people about lithium, and lithium is expensive because of the materials, because of the processing and so on. But you're saying that this approach, the cost is much lower with a zinc and recyclable materials process.
Yes, I would say that, yeah.
And what about the charge it holds, or less or more?
It's going to be less. The key reason is the voltage of the zinc chemistry is lower. It's only about 1 volt. And lithium-ion battery can go up to 3 to 4 volt.
So it wouldn't be in your computer batteries or your electric vehicle batteries where you want to have a lot of energy in a small amount of space. But if you've got some kind of big farm that's taking up electricity from, let's say, a solar farm or a wind farm, and to stabilize the electric supply, that's the kind of use you're thinking of, is it?
Yes, you're exactly right, yeah. And in that case, cost and the lifetime are more important than energy density because you're not driving the battery around. You know?
So if you succeed in this development, I'm sure there's still quite a lot to be done, and you fill some kind of warehouse with zinc, chitosan, crab shell batteries, what would you be doing with them at the end of life? I mean, is that a process you've worked on as well?
If the chemistry is right, we can dispose most of the component, like this cathode material we use is an organic-based material, as well as the zinc ion-based electrolyte. So those components can be, you know, biodegradable. And you basically, yeah, I mean, either recycle the entire battery or dispose the major parts of the battery at the end of the life of those batteries.
And you said that there's a vast supply of crab shells that could be used. I mean, is there actually commercially available the quantities of crab shells that you would need to supply the world with this kind of battery?
You know, in the world, we're facing two problems. One is hunger, you know. Why is energy, right? And we are hunger for food. We're also hunger for energy. There are actually a lot of companies working on this kind of chitin or chitin materials out of the seafood, for example, we've been contacted by quite a few major suppliers actually in the United States. And actually we're talking to them, and this kind of a study, the potential use of this material in new technologies can actually further motivate those businesses and even provide a incentive for better management of the food waste. And worldwide, each year, there's about 100 million tons of those materials produced by those bioorganisms.
And that's stuff which either has to be thrown away or could be used, let's say, in your batteries.
Yeah, so there's a lot of material. And this membrane, remember, this membrane is actually very, very thin. It's less than the thickness of a typical paper. A typical paper is about 100 micron. In those battery membranes, the thickness is about 25 micron.
Those millions of tons will go a long way. Do you, at this stage, I know it's early stage in the development, you really think this could happen?
Given the demand of battery technologies and the demand of materials associated with those technologies, and I believe there's going to be a very interesting future for this kind of materials used in batteries.
Liang Binghu, his prototype battery is outlined in the journal Matter. And with that, it's time for me, Runner Pease, and producers Zach Brophy and Robbie Wojciechowski to charge off. And as we stampede over the horizon, we're counting on crowd science to find out if animals are numerate.
This is Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. I'm Marnie Chesterton, and today we start in the grasslands of Tanzania, in the Serengeti, to observe lions. Technically, I'm here in a BBC studio, much safer, but in my mind, I'm totally there. And it's all because of how lions behave when another group of lions approach.
Now, lions are territorial. They live in prides, and they try and defend their territory and their pride from intruders. And if they hear intruders at dusk, that's when the intruders usually come, coming through the bush. So they can't see them, but they can hear them.
With me is Brian Butterworth, Emeritus Professor of Cognitive Neuropsychology at University College London. He's explaining that these big cats are facing some twilight dilemmas.
So they might hear three intruding lions, so they recognise their voices as not being from their own pride. What will they do? Now, if lions fight, it can be very dangerous, even fatal. So they have to be very careful what they do.
How do our lions make the right calculation? Is that the correct word? Which brings me to our listener, Mamadou, and what he wants to know.
My name is Mamadou. I'm a student at Jala University. I'm from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Now, you've got an interesting question for crowd science. What is it?
My question is, can animals count?
Have you seen any example of any animal that makes you think that this is possible?
Maybe chimpanzees. We have quite a few of them here, you know, and from videos, you know, they do interesting stuff, like, you know, they tie shoelaces. Sometimes when you watch those videos, you see them, like, putting stones together or fruits, you know.
I just like this idea that maths might be another thing that we've got in common with other animals.
Yeah, for us humans, it's very easy for us to quantify stuff. It would be also be interesting to know whether or not animals, how they use numbers to help them in their daily lives.
Okay, we're going to do some digging and then let you know what we find. How's that sound?
That sounds amazing.
Thank you, Mamadou. So, can animals count? Complex algebra feels like something restricted to us humans, but maybe that's just my human-centric arrogance. And maths isn't all or nothing. Even those of us who hated being taught it can still count up to 10. We're going to find out what the rest of the animal kingdom can do, whether some animals are geniuses with numbers, if others are dunces. But first, I think we should define terms. What do I mean by counting? A way to define it is having an understanding of the amount of things in your environment, also called the number of a set. So if I'm standing in front of four trees, I can tell that there are four of them, and I can tell the difference between four trees and, let's say, two trees. I have a mental representation of fourness in my head. This, in the scientific literature, is also called number sense. You're sensing the numbers around you. So with that definition in mind, let's go back to Professor Brian Butterworth. He's the author of the recent book, Can Fish Count? You know how there's a scientific area for almost every interesting aspect of life on this planet and beyond it? Well, there's a field called mathematical cognition. Scientists searching the animal kingdom for signs of counting abilities. And after 3 decades immersed in it, Brian is bursting with stories of animals and their number skills. Talking of which, let's head back to the Serengeti, to our pride of lions. There are 6 of them, and they're trying to make out, just by listening, how many intruders there are. Are they hearing a specific roar?
They're hearing specific roars from, let's say, 3 intruders. And they look around and they see how many of them there are. Now, the way this is done actually is not with real intruders, but with loudspeakers set up at the boundary of the pride's territory.
So what, the scientists played the sound of intruders to this pride?
Yes.
Who couldn't see them because it was dark?
There were only loudspeakers there. But had it been a real event, then yes, they wouldn't have been able to see the intruders in all probability. They would just have heard them roaring as they approached the pride's territory.
Here are the actual roars of 3 female lions that Karen McComb from the University of Sussex used in this ingenious experiment. For the lions, this is a very dangerous situation. Put up a fight when you're outnumbered, and you could lose your territory, or worse, your life. So how do the 6 lions ensure they make the right move? They compare 2 numbers, how many intruders and how many of them.
So they're comparing an auditory 3-ness with a visual 6-ness, so they will approach the intruders.
So what happened when they played them more roars than there were number of physical lions in the pride?
Well, they would back off. Unless there were cubs. If there were cubs, then they might well try and attack the intruders, because intruding lions can be infanticidal. They kill the cubs of the pride that they're attacking.
There you have it. Lions count in the wild and do so to defend their territory, for survival. Now, lions are mammals. They're social animals with large brains, so it may not be surprising that they can do this. Let's focus on something smaller, simpler, and further away in evolutionary terms from us and our mathematical abilities. Can amphibians count? Take the Tungara frog. It's only about 30 millimetres long and lives in Central and bits of South America.
I want you to imagine you're a female frog in a swamp, probably at twilight, and you decide it's your time to mate, and you want to choose the fittest male. You can't see them because it's dark and it's a swamp, but you can hear them. And, of course, the males know this, and they make what are called advertisement calls. And the advertisement calls, which I can't imitate, I'm afraid.
I thought, thought we were going to get.
No, but it's a kind of downward sweep and then a series of what are called chucks, which are short, harmonically dense notes, a bit like croaks.
The croaks are the sexy bit.
The croaks are the sexy bit.
Presumably there's an element of danger as well, because if you're making a great racket, you're telling other things that might eat you where you are.
I'm afraid that's true. There are creatures that actually prey on these tiny frogs, and they are actually attracted by the chucks as well. So if a male frog is making a lot of chucks, it's more likely to get eaten. But then I don't know if this is typical male behaviour. They're kind of risky when it comes to sex.
So the male Tungara frog faces a tough choice. Make more noise, more of those chucks, and he will get more female frog attention, but also more frog-eating predator attention. So how many chucks is enough to safely find a mate? When every chuck counts, it helps if you can actually count.
So male A will make, let's say, 4 croaks, which will, he hopes, attract a female. But his neighbouring frog hears his 4 croaks per phrase, so he ups it by 1 and croaks 5 croaks per phrase.
So it could just go on forever?
There's a limit to their lung capacity. Actually, they've got a sac that expands as well as their lungs. So, you know, it's probably a limit of about 6 or 7 croaks. And so the female makes her way to the male that produces the most croaks.
Sexy counting frogs. So it seems that even amphibians possess this numerical ability. In both of our animal examples so far, the common factor seems to be social interaction within the same species. The lions use counting for defending territory, and in the case of frogs, it helps find a mate. So maybe counting is part of the language of communication. It certainly feels like counting in animals is an inevitable consequence of reaching a certain level of intelligence and sociability. Would Brian agree?
Absolutely not.
No?
No.
Which animals can't count?
We don't know.
Oh.
We don't know which animals can't, because if you test them and they fail your test, maybe you've got the wrong test.
Maybe right? You've done a stupid test.
You haven't understood the psychology of that particular animal. So sociability might be important, but it may not be.
Why is it relevant for animals to have a sense of number? I'm getting a sense that it is very important.
It's very important. We've seen that it's important in defence of your territory. It's also avoidance of death. It's about finding food. It's important for sex. So there are lots of reasons why being able to assess the number of things in your environment is going to be important for animals.
So counting means more chance of a meal or sex and less chance of being killed. And that's really not how they sold addition and subtraction at my school. And if this skill is as fundamental to animals' survival as it seems, are there genes for counting or a special part of the brain? According to Brian, how animals count is a big unanswered mystery.
Well, we don't know the way in which the brain mechanisms for most of these creatures work. So even where we know something about the brain mechanisms in monkeys and humans and crows, it's not quite clear how this works. I mean, we know that there are neurons that respond to particular numerosities. We know that in humans, it's a particular bit of the brain that's always active, whichever kind of number task you're doing, whether it's, you know, symbols, whether it's words, whether it's dots on the screen, it's always the same bit of the brain that's active. And this is connected to the frontal lobes in humans, because that's where you decide how you're going to do the task and whether you've done the task okay. We know that in monkeys, the frontal lobe is also involved. So there seems to be a parallelism there. But, you know, monkeys and humans diverged evolutionarily only 30 million years ago. What about birds, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago? Are there genes that they have and we have that have built the relevant brain mechanisms? We don't really know, because we haven't really identified the genes yet. So the genetic basis is still not understood.
You're listening to Crowd Science from the BBC World Service, and we're answering our listener Mamadou's question, can animals count? We've found out that numbers can be very useful for eating, mating and not being killed. That's why lions defend their territories and frogs find mating partners by perceiving and comparing numbers. And while the neural and genetic foundations of this number sense are still unclear, we can't even discount the possibility that all animals can count, because if an animal doesn't respond to your experiment, that doesn't mean they can't do it. But so far, we've just been talking about what animals do naturally in the wild. Is it possible to test animals' counting abilities by teaching them to count something different, something they wouldn't usually encounter? Why look at this? It comes back to the definition of being able to count. Yes, those frogs can tell chuck numbers, but if you're counting, you can do it whether you're counting fingers on your hands or trees in a park, whatever. It's about sensing the number of anything around us. Can animals do that? To find out, we'll be moving on to a species that is even further away from us on the evolutionary tree. Bees.
Currently I have a box that is connected to the hive by a tunnel.
I'm in a bee lab at Queen Mary University in London, speaking to postdoc Mai Morimoto. On the left, there's a small hive with lots of bumblebees in it, going about their busy bee day. Some of them have left and are exploring the see-through corridor which connects the hive to a box on the right, the flight arena. And only the more adventurous bees, the foragers, will venture out. For her experiment, Mai only wants this specific forager class.
Yeah, you have to find the good forager in the morning, and then you work with those good foragers for the day or throughout the week. And I also label them. So this pink one over here is the one that is particularly motivated today.
I'm here because in this very lab, researchers study the cognitive abilities of bees. The head of the lab is Professor Lars Chitka, author of the recent book The Mind of a Bee. And he conducted a numerical experiment with an experimental setup very much like the one here today. And here's how it worked.
So the bee walks through a little perspex tunnel from her nest to the flight arena.
The bee exits the tunnel and takes flight.
And when she enters the flight arena, she can see 16 different patterns.
Ones with two, three, or four items on them.
Each of these patterns has a little balcony that the bee can land on.
The bee hovers in front of a display with three blobs on it.
All the patterns that have three items in them, no matter what these items are, will be associated with a sugar reward.
And lands on the balcony in front of it.
So that was a correct choice. Oh, well done, forager bee.
But the forager bee is still hungry, so she looks around for more.
Now it's flying up.
And so the bee has to land on multiple correct patterns with the number of three before her tummy is filled once.
She finds another pattern with three stars and has a little drink there.
Next one along. Yes, it's correct.
Once she's full.
Until she's full.
There we go. Let's pick the last one.
All right. And flies back to the hive.
Unloads what she's collected.
Regurgitates the sugar water into these honey pots.
And is immediately up for doing another round.
And how many times a day can you do that with the same bee?
Usually the human experimenter gets tired before the bee does.
How difficult is all of this for a bee?
The bees learn the task just fine. So they pick out even new patterns that have the number three. Even if these are patterns that the bee hasn't been exposed to before, they pick all the ones that have three items in them, but not other numbers.
So bees can learn how to count things, blobs or stars on a display. Very impressive.
Well, the interesting thing was how they solved this task.
And to understand why that's so interesting, you first need to know how we, and many other animals, solve this task. For small amounts, up to about 4 to 6, we can simply look at the items and know immediately what the number is.
Without sequentially going and pointing your finger at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you can look at the number of dots on a die, for example, and say, 4. At these very small numbers, the judgment of correct numbers is very fast in humans, so they don't have to count them off sequentially.
This mechanism is called subitizing, and many other animals, including primates, perceive numbers this way, almost instantly. Unlike what we do for higher numbers, we have to count items one by one using our counting words.
If, for example, I give you the task of discriminating 40 from 42 dots or something, then, of course, the amount of time that it will take you to solve this task is the amount of time that it actually takes you to count these items one by one. And as opposed to us humans, where you just glance at a number and say, 3, the bees counted these items one by one. And the bees do that not by pointing fingers, but actually by briefly inspecting with their whole body position. So they fly to an item in a display, stop in front of it briefly before flying to the next item, stopping briefly, and so on.
So the bees weren't able to subitize. They couldn't just glance at the screen and tell how many dots there were. They had to go one, two, three. But on the other hand, I feel that counting things one by one is an incredibly human thing to do.
You're right. So there's a bit of both. The bees don't do it by pointing the fingers at the items to be counted, but with their whole bodies. But yeah, there is a curious similarity there as well, in addition to it being different.
So does that mean that bees have a real concept of each number, at least have one, two, three, four?
Indeed, it is a simple form of concept learning. So at the very least, you have to have a kind of concept of two-ness or three-ness that lumps together all kinds of different displays that have either three yellow dots or three blue crosses or three black triangles, and to extract a property that unites all of these different patterns by there being three of something in them.
Clever little bees. It turns out we may have been underestimating these insects. They've shown that not just can they correctly judge the number of things in their environment, but this ability can be tested using wacky symbols that aren't useful for the bee in nature. Different animals may have different ways of doing this, with some perceiving numbers at a glance, whilst bees, it seems, count them one by one. But again, up in their little bee brains, are they saying one, two, three, four? We don't know, partly because of the language barrier. We're coming back to that definition of counting again, because some of the most famous animal maths work has been done by comparative psychologist Irene Pepperberg and her co-worker, an African grey parrot, Alex. And Irene has a much higher bar for what counts as counting.
So counting is a very, very specific task. It's quite different from having a simple number sense, like being able to recognize more versus less, or being able to label very tiny sets of objects like one, two, and three. Almost every animal that we've studied can recognize the difference between one, two, and three, and that's not counting. Counting means that you have a number line, like you can recite one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. You understand that each number and that number line corresponds to a single object in a set of things you're trying to enumerate. You understand that the last number that you reach is the number of the entire set. You understand that every number in your number line is one more than the one before it and one less than the one after it. And you have both comprehension and production of these numerals that you're talking about. And only three non-humans have succeeded in this: Boyson's Sheba, Matsuzawa's I, and Alex.
Oh, so it's not three classes of animals, it's three individual animals.
Correct.
Wait, what? I've been telling you about counting abilities in lions, frogs, and bees, and now Irene's saying that only two chimpanzees and Alex have passed her test of being able to recite the numbers in a row and understanding the relationships between them. I get back in touch with Brian Butterworth. Who is right?
Well, of course, it depends what you mean by counting. In my book, Can Fish Count?, the way I define it is to say that can an animal actually assess the exact numerical value of a set, exactly how many things there are in a set, or at least as accurately as we can. Dr. Pepperberg's criteria for what counts as counting is essentially the same as one would apply to children learning to count with counting words. And that's not really applicable to animals in any case.
So according to Irene's stricter and potentially more human criteria, only three individual animals have managed to count. The first two she mentioned, I and Sheba, are chimpanzees. Our listener Mamadou was correct to think of chimps when he came up with his question. But the third one was a very special bird, Alex the parrot, who, crucially for another species, could speak English. About 500 words, once trained by Irene. Back in 1995, BBC science journalist Andrew Luck Baker visited Irene's lab and, luckily for us, kept a cassette tape of Irene and a colleague interacting with Alex.
Okay, what we have on this tray are objects of different color, shapes, and materials. And we're going to ask Alex to tell us the matter of the object that's orange. Okay, Alex, you look on the tray. You can touch them all.
What matter orange, Alex?
Whoa!
Good boy. Whoa, good bird. Yeah.
Good parrot.
Good birdie.
That's a good birdie. Yes, you can pick out from that.
What did you teach him initially?
We started with labels for objects so that he could access different toys. We gave him labels for places that he could go in the lab, so he learned I want X and want to go Y. So overall, he learned about 100 different labels for various objects and materials and places and foods. He learned 7 colors and 5 shapes. He learned quantities up to 8. And we taught him to understand Arabic numerals, because that was quite difficult. I mean, you were showing him that, you know, 6 blobs of something was called 6, the vocal label, and this one squiggle was called 6. But we never trained him that squiggle and the blobs were equivalent, but he did that on his own.
Oh, clever parrot.
Okay, we're going to show Alex a few Arabic numerals and see if he can identify them for us.
You tell me, what number?
Well, what number? Pay attention.
Here. What number?
4.
No,
no.
Alex.
You look. What number?
3.
Good birdie.
3. Good boy.
Okay, here's a nut.
You notice Alex said 4, then 3. Irene told me that some days he'd give you the wrong numbers on purpose. Maybe he enjoyed the mind games. He certainly enjoyed number games. Here's a story Irene told me of working with another parrot called Griffin.
We were training Griffin on sequential sounds, but we were just messing around with Griffin one afternoon and we were clicking. So we used, you know, clicks. How many? And I asked Griffin, and he looks at me and he turns his little beak and he won't. And I go, Griffin, listen. How many? And he turns his little beak, won't answer. And on the next cage, Alex goes, 4.
4?
No.
And I look at him, I say, no, you're wrong. And I go over to Griffin, I say, listen, how many? And Alex says, 6.
Good birdie.
You're right.
6.
Which actually says is 6 at that point, because he couldn't do that final S easily. And I look at him and I realize he's adding all those clicks. So that's what triggered our study of the actual addition project.
And then, crucially, he could talk to you and tell you when he did his calculations.
Correct. So we could show him one set under that we hit under one plastic cup and another set that we hit under another plastic cup. So we'd pick it up, show him, look, you know, what was under one cup, look what's under the other cup. And then with both cups hiding the numbers, we could ask him how many total. And he was correct on that. And we could then eventually substitute Arabic numerals for the sets, and he was equally correct. And we were just starting subtraction when he passed away. And it was only after he died that, you know, I realized how much I had cared for him and how much I missed him.
Alex died unexpectedly in 2007, after Irene had been working with him for 3 decades. Now, African grey parrots can live up to 80 years in captivity. Unfortunately, we'll never know what else he might have achieved had he not passed away at a younger age. Nevertheless, Alex is the best example of human-like counting outside of chimpanzees. But why is that? While chimps are our close cousins, grey parrots and their brains are incredibly different from our own.
We're separated by 300 and some odd million years of evolution, but for grey parrots at least, if you look at where they live in Africa and their lifestyle, they have very similar evolutionary pressures as the apes. Okay, they're long-lived species like the apes. They forage 60 kilometers a day like the apes.
that they have to remember over their long lives. Where's the different foods? What, you know, new food sources appeared? What food sources have passed away? They have a complex social life. I mean, right now, unfortunately, they've been predated so horribly, but it used to be flocks of 100 birds. And you have a dominance hierarchy, so just like the apes. So this is what's really important in terms of understanding why they're so intelligent.
Do you think that his abilities, which are, as you say, incredibly unusual for the animal kingdom, I mean, not quite unique, but pretty much, how much of that do you think was down to him having the words, the counting words?
I think that was incredibly important. I mean, think about us. We can only do maths if we have these symbols. Okay, if I just give you a big set of blobs of something and another big set of blobs and I say how many total, you have no idea. I mean, you can give me an approximate, like, okay, there's 20 versus 100. Okay, but you can only tell me there are 18 if you can actually count them and have this numerical representation of a symbol.
So perhaps it's not just our innate intelligence, but our counting words that propel our mathematical abilities beyond those of other animals. But Mamadou asked us if animals can count. And yes, I'd say Alex the parrot is the perfect example of a counting animal. But what about less smart birds? Chickens don't have the vocab that Alex had, so they, like most animals, will remain more of a mystery. However, we've learnt that many, many animals, potentially all animals, can grasp small amounts and have a sense of more or less because it allows them to make the decisions in the wild that result in getting more food, more sex, and less danger of death. So all the best reasons. But where we and Alex do seem to go beyond personal counting is that we also have a way of communicating those numerical abilities with each other. Actually, multiple ways. We've created verbal and symbolic representations of numbers and educated each new generation about them, which allows us to work out the square root or do complex algebra, which, you could argue, allows us to do more complex counting, which sets us apart. You could equally argue that we have no idea what kind of mental arithmetic other species are doing or communicating. Don't those lions from the top of the show need to share a number sense in order to coordinate their strategy? Maybe whales are far superior to us at counting, but just in ways we can't currently test. So maybe next time you watch a bumblebee fly past you, think about how it might be counting as it's buzzing by. Back to Mamadou for the credits.
That's it for this episode of Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. It was presented by Marnie Chestetin and produced by Florian Bohr. Today's question came from me, Mamadou Bari, in Freetown, Sierra Leone. If you have a science question you would like the team to look into, then just like me, you can email crowdscience@bbc.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.